the yoga of the rise of the soul from this world is the main subject of the 8th chapter of the Bhagavad Gita. Usually, the soul reverts to this world on account of the pull that the world atmosphere exerts upon it. As the power of gravitation can pull everything towards the earth, all desires connected with the world are the forces that drag the soul back to the world. And any kind of impulsion to which the soul gets subjected becomes its bondage. And liberation of the spirit is freedom from such subjection. How can this be achieved? This is answer in a few verses of the 8th chapter. Sarvadvarani samyamya mano hridi niruddhyacha murdhriya adhaya atmana prana asthido yogadharanam omityekaksharam brahma vyaharam mamanusmaran yah prayati tyajan deham sayati paramamrutim. Only in 2 verses the whole of the yoga that one has to engage oneself in at the time of the departure from this world is described. All the doors of the senses have to be closed. That is the samyamana, or the restraint of all the gates by which the senses move towards their object. Sarvadvarani samyamya. It is not easy to shut out the senses from their activity in connection with their objects, because this is not a physical doorway which you can close at your will. This is an impulse which is hard to restrain. In the way you cannot control the movement of wind, for instance, by any amount of effort. The methodology of sense restraint is described in various places in the Bhagavad Gita in different contexts. The control of the senses is not easy if we are to confine ourselves merely to the area or the field of sense activity. We have to apply a higher power in order to restrain a lower urge. And unless we resort to a higher resource that is in us, we would not be able to draw enough strength in order to handle these impetuosity of the sense organs. If we are to think merely of the senses and then merely by the power of thought attempt to control them, we would not be entirely successful, because the lower mind, which is the sense mind, is in collaboration with the senses, and it is the mind that okays the requirements or the demands of the sense organs. Thus, the lower mind is not going to be a help. The higher mind, which is the superior reason within us, has to be employed in order to harness a greater power for dealing with the senses, which move of their own accord towards the objects. For that, a The prescription is given in this very verse, Mano Hridi Nirudhya Cha. The mind has to be centered in the heart. And this instruction follows the other, whereby we are told that the gates of the senses have to be closed. Sarva Dwarani Samyamya Mano Hridi Nirudhya Cha. The centering of the mind in the heart is also an art by itself. It is to locate the mind in its own center, where is to be found its own roots. We hear in the studies of psychology, for instance, that there are layers of mind beneath the conscious level, and the conscious operations are mostly a surface activity of our consciousness. There are deeper layers which are buried beneath the conscious activities, and they are the impulsions which propel the mind to okay the activities of the senses. The centering of the mind in the heart is in a way the directing of the mind to pure subjectivity of feeling. The heart is the center of all feelings, which are the immediate expressions of our true being. The essential nature of our own selves is behind the feelings, which manifests itself, reveals itself in the psychic expressions which we know as feelings. They are very powerful. Everything is controlled by feeling finally. The mind has to be centered in the root of feeling, the very base of all emotions and sentiments. And this has to be done by an effort of mind itself. Usually we think through the brain whenever we are wakeful and conscious of external objects. We have to apply an inward technique of driving the mind inwardly to the heart, which is not necessarily the physical heart, but a state of feeling which is inseparable from the location of what we call the heart center. We have a subtle body inward to the physical body and the psychic heart, though it is not identical with the physical heart, can be regarded as an inwardized counterpart of the physical heart. So the yoga practice mentioned here is not a physical activity. It is an effort of consciousness, whereby the whole of the arena of the senses and of the mind is restrained by a superior consciousness, which centers itself in its own self. Sarva dvarani samyamya mano hridi niruddhya cha. Murdhni adhaya atmana pranam asthudo yoga dharana. There is another instruction which makes out that the pranas should not be allowed to move in the way in which they are moving at present. There should be an automatic restraint exerted upon their activities by an act of the concentration of the mind. The technique specially mentioned here is the concentration on the center between the two eyebrows, the Bhrumadhyam, as it is called. This is not the only method of yoga, there are others also, but this is one specific technique that is precisely mentioned here in these two verses, apart from the various other instructions that we find in different places elsewhere in the very same scripture. perhaps the intention of this admonition is that our reason and the feeling should go together in the act of concentration on God. We should not be purely rationalistic individuals minus feeling, nor should we be merely emotional, sentimental, feelingful people without understanding. The two have to go together, and this again is a very difficult feat. We are driven by emotions or dry logic with the preponderance of this or that at different times, and rarely do we become integrated personalities where our rationality combines with the feeling, which is the deepest essence in us psychologically. Intuition, in a way, may be said to be a blend of understanding or reason and the feeling. If you feel what you understand and understand what you feel, you become a complete being. But normally, this is not done. We generally keep these two apart with no intimate relationship between them, so that it is not necessarily true that we feel what we understand or even understand what we feel. There are irrational instincts, as we call them, which are our deepest feelings, which, like a cyclone, blow over us and drag us in the direction they move, like a tempest or a tornado. And the rationality behind them is beyond us. We always say, well, we did it somehow by an impulsion, without understanding. On the other hand, there is also the logician's brain, which is bereft of human feelings, and the mathematical approach to personal and social existence of people cannot be regarded as the whole of life. Mathematical logic cannot be always humane. It may be a precise instrument, like a machine, but machine has no feeling. It does not understand the sentiments or the requirements of people. To be a true human being, in the complete sense of the term, there has to be a coming together of understanding and feeling. When this is carried to its limits, the furthest end of this combination, we are on the borderland of the flash of intuition. Intuition is a total approach of the subject in respect of the object. Here you are discussing the supreme object of meditation, God Himself, and not merely an ordinary object. But this method can be applied in respect of the lower things also. As we are told about the various techniques of Samya, which are the themes in some of the sutras of Patanjali, for instance, that this directing of the being in concentration can be done in respect of anything in this world. But at present, in the context of these verses of the Bhagavad Gita, we are speaking of the salvation of the soul, the liberation of the spirit, and not merely a samyama for powers or siddhis in respect of the temporal things of the world. In the concentration of God, the whole of the personality is gathered up and focused. Every cell of the body unites in collaboration with every other, and every thought combines with every other thought. As a whole nation can voluntarily offer itself for conscription if there is a tremendous danger which threatens the entire country, There is a uniting of powers on account of the necessity felt due to the exigency of the occasion. And what can be a more serious occasion than the departure of the soul from this world? It is the most consequent event that can ever take place in our lives, where our future is decided, where the last judgment is to be declared in respect of the destiny of the soul that has to leave this world for its future career. So the great teacher in the Gita tells us that we have to gather ourselves up into a soul and not merely a psyche. The psyche melts into the soul. The mind and the reason become one with the self within us, the Atma or the consciousness. When buddhi and manas, reason and feeling come together, the head and the heart go hand in hand and not as two divided powers. Murdhanyadhaya atmana pranam asthito yogadharanam. Now towards this end, another advice is given here. All this is not easy to practice. Whatever be the detail or the instruction that you may listen to in respect of this great yoga, when we actually come to it, we will find that it is beyond us. The mind will revolt and the senses will clamor for satisfaction. Even at the point of death, desires do not cease. And they become more acute. Oftentimes it is said that when they are sensing a destructive stroke that is about to be dealt at their very roots by the phenomenon of death that is to take place, they become extremely strong. And even the desires that you would not be usually thinking in normal life would come to the surface at that time when you are about to quit this world. Everything that you would have pushed into the subconscious or the unconscious level would come up at the time of the departure from this world. You would be in a miserable condition when they all come up and ask for their dues. Death is the shaking up of the whole of the body and the entire psyche, whereas all the sheaths of the body. There, the concentration of the mind on God is a practical impossibility for ordinary persons. Some advice in the direction of making ourselves ready for this practice is in concern with the chanting of Om or Pranava. Om ityekaksharam brahma vyaharan maam anusmaran. There are two pieces of advice in this half verse. Om ityekaksharam brahma vyaharan maam anusmaran. Reciting the great mantra which is Pranava or Om, and absorbing the whole of our being in the being of God. We have to leave this world, depart to the higher realms. The recitation of Om or the chanting of Pranava is prescribed as a part of this practice of yoga, the Antima Yoga of the 8th chapter. The recitation of Om is a common practice among all religious devotees. The pranava is attached to every mantra, and whenever we begin any religious performance or ablution, we repeat the mantra Om. The idea behind this recitation is to gather up our energies into a completeness, so that we become filled with a vibration which is to be in sympathy with the vibration that originated this universe itself. The Om mantra that we chant is not merely a word that we utter. It is not a sound that we produce, but a vibration that is generated from every part of our system. So that, often it is said that the chant of Om has to rise from the nabhi or the navel, the root of our body, and not merely from the lips or the throat, which means to say that the whole of our being has to be shaken when we chant Om. This word, this letter, this sound symbol, Om, is recognized as the word of God, the seed of all wisdom and knowledge, the origin of all language, ultimately. Any language can be traced to this root of Om, which is the comprehensive word, wherein the entire vocal system begins to operate totally. In the utterance of the letters of the alphabet, ka, kha, ga, gha, or A, B, C, D, and so on, some part of the system, the vocal cords, begin to operate. But here, the whole of the sound box begins to operate. This is the reason why perhaps linguists and philologists have opined that the recitation of Om or the chanting of Om is equivalent to the repeating of every letter or every word or producing every kind of sound which goes to constitute the letter of any alphabet of any language. Now, the significance behind this chant is again not merely to utter a word or make a sound, but to set up a vibration. And what sort of vibration it will be can be known by each one of you by actually resorting to this practice. With a calm and settled mood, the chanting has to be done. And the personality has to be felt as if it is melting away into its atmosphere, so that the vibrations that are the sum and substance or the material of the things of the world gets in tune with the substance of our own body or personality, which means to say we reduce ourselves to the ultimate cause from which the effects have come forth in the form of the various bodies of individuals. All the bodies can be reduced to a single vibration, a universal continuum of energy, whether it is the body of a man, the body of an animal, or the body of a tree, the body of a stone, it makes no difference. Any substance, any body, any embodiment can be converted into an energy which reduces itself to a minimum of reality, inseparable from this very same minimum of reality, forming the essence of every body in this world. So, psychologically, mentally, and by an effort of the mind, we dissolve ourselves gradually into this universal energy. And Om is more a vibration than a sound. There is a difference between sound and vibration. Just as you can understand very well that energy is not the same as sound. Because while energy can manifest itself as sound, it can also manifest itself as something else, such as color, taste, smell, etc., like electric energy.
It can manifest itself as locomotion. It can manifest itself as heat. It can manifest itself as light, and so on and so forth. The various configurations in the form of bodies or things in this world are expressions locally of this universal vibration, which is the cosmic impulse to creation, the creativity or the will of God, which is identified with the cosmic energy. Om is the symbol of this cosmic force. Nada, Bindu, Kala are the terms used in some of the systems of thought to designate the various stages of the development of this energy into grosser and grosser form from a single point. It expands itself into the dimension of this universe in space and time. And from merely being an impersonal, unthinkable, supernatural power, energy or vibration, it becomes visible, tangible, sensible, thinkable and reasonable when it manifests itself as this gross universe and our own body. In this yoga practice, we concentrate on the aspect of the dissolution of the physical body in the subtle in the causal, and the causal in the cosmic substance. So the chant of Om is not merely a word, but also an effort of the mind in the dissolution of personality, in the causes thereof. And this is what is advised in this verse of the Gita. Om ityekaksharam Brahma. It is said it is the absolute itself. It is saguna and nirguna. It is with form and without form. The vibration can be conceived as identical with the absolute in its original causative aspect. It can also be conceived as the seed of the cosmos. Therefore it is called saguna and nirguna both. It is absolute, Brahma, because it is all comprehensive. There is nothing outside it, just as the continuum of energy. The force that is the source of this world cannot be regarded as having anything outside it or external to it. Brahma is anything outside which nothing is, that which comprehends all, that which includes everything, into which everything is absorbed, wherein anything can be found in any form, at any time, under any circumstance. That completeness is called Brahma. And Om is such symbol which represents the Supreme Absolute. This yoga is therefore combined with the chanting of Om in this manner prescribed. Om ityekaksharam Brahma. Vyaharan mam anusmaran. It is not merely a chant or a recitation in a verbal form that is prescribed, but also an inward attunement of our feeling, mind, reason and consciousness. The thought of God is essential, together with the recitation or the chant. The mind should not wander. When you chant Om, you must also feel what you are chanting. And not merely feel, but also understand what it is. The whole being is there. That is called yoga, the union of the totality of being with the wholeness of the object. Such a person who departs from this world by the practice of yoga in this manner reaches the supreme state. He is not reborn, does not come back to this world of mortality. Yah prayati tyajan deham sa yati paramamgati. All this may look very terrific, almost impractical, for people living in this humdrum world of activity and business. Is this yoga meant for me? The great teacher says, don't be afraid. I am very easy of approach. I am not a difficult person, as you may imagine me. Ananya cheta satatam yomam smarati nityasaha tasyaham sulapaha. I am very easy of attainment for those who are intently united with me, who want me, and want nothing else. The great qualification that is expected of a devotee or a yogi is the asking for God and not learning or study of scriptures. You need not be a degree holder or an academic master in a theoretical philosophy. No qualification is necessary in the path of God. Even the rustics, even the unknown persons who never went to any school or field of training could become vehicles of the expression of God, as the history of religion will demonstrate to us. The whole soul should require God, and this requiring God is the qualification. The mind should not affiliate itself with anything other than this supreme object. This is called ananya chetasa. The mind not engaging itself in any other thought. There should be one thought. Now this one thought is the most difficult thing for many of us, because we have never seen what this one thought could be. The difficulty arises because the soul does not ask God. The reason may be asking in its logical manner, but the soul is beclouded by the dark longings of the senses, which, when they are not fulfilled, remain like a cloud covering the light of the Atma. We cannot concentrate on one thing because we do not want that thing, really speaking. Our asking for God is not an asking by the mouth, a prayer that is uttered by the chanting of a song or a linguistic prayer. It is a surging of our feelings and an impossibility to exist without God. Great saints and sages have passed through this crucial hour and a difficult moment, when they began to feel that even death is better than loss of God consciousness. Because the soul writhes and wriggles to catch that without which it cannot breathe even. And for us who have not been accustomed to this whole soul devotion, the practice of yoga remains as a kind of alien instruction. Ananyajetaha satatam, tremendous conditions are laid, though it is said that the whole attainment is very easy. It appears, if you try to understand the meaning of the shloka, that the teacher or the master of the Gita is telling us that he is easy of approach, provided that something is done. This provision is very difficult one again. The whole mind has to be united. You have to be ananya chitta. This ananya chittatva, or the unitedness of your thoughts or feelings, the mind and the reason with the Supreme Being, should be continuous and not be with remission of effort. So, satatam, the whole day and night should be thinking of that only. Ananya cheta satatam, yo mam smarati nityashah. Daily one is resorting to this practice. Continuity, practice daily in the unitedness of all our being with God. Tasyaham sulabha, to such a person I am easy. Nitya yuktasya yogina, to the yogi who is united with me perpetually, I am easy of approach. Tasyaham sulabha partha nitya yuktasya yogina. After attaining God, there is no rebirth. Mam upetya punar janma dukkhalayam ashashvatam napunvanti mahatmana samsiddhim paramamgata. Reaching all the planes of existence lower to God, there can be reversion. of the soul to those conditions where its unfulfilled desires can manifest themselves for fulfillment. When God is the sole object of desire, where desires fulfill themselves entirely at one stroke, there remains no other desire to pull the soul back to the earth or to any lower plane of existence. Punarjanma, rebirth, as I mentioned last time, is not necessarily rebirth in this world. It is a rebirth in any condition of being, any plane of existence, anywhere in creation, any part of the cosmos, which is supposed to be infinite in number, and any state which is less than the realization of God is a rebirth. It may be in any lower plane, but the whole process of reincarnation is rent asunder, is cut at the root. When the cause behind rebirth itself is plucked out from its very roots, and the cause is the sense of individuality, the isolation of oneself from God, the assertion of the ego, and everything that follows from it as a consequence. The whole of samsara, the whole drama of life, is the affirmation of the ego personality of the jiva, as if it is all in all and master of its own self, reigning supreme in this world of mortality, in this world of desires and fulfillment of the same. This is the sorrow of man. But no desire can be fulfilled in this manner. The ego is futilely attempting to fulfill its desires by grabbing things in this world. The more it desires, the more are the multitude of desires that crop up like Rakta Bija, you hear of in the story of the Devi Mahatmya. The more you shed the blood of that Rakshasa, the more he multiplies himself into a large army which takes up weapons in the field of battle. This Rakta Bija of the Devi Mahatmya is nothing but desire itself. It cannot be rooted out completely. Its fulfillment is not its destruction. On the other hand, any kind of pampering of a desire by merely satisfying it in an externalized form is to intensify it, because the samskara or the impression that is created in the mind at the time of the so-called satisfaction or the fulfillment of a desire forms a groove in the mind, and that groove becomes a source of further impulse from within to repeat this experience, and desires continue like a chain action without cessation. The desire ceases when their root is pulled out. The root is the affirmation of the ego. The ego cannot absolve itself of attachment to its own being unless it dedicates itself to God. The ego will never turn to God, because it is also an affirmation, and an affirmation contrary to the all being of God. While God is all being, ego is individual being. That is their difference. So the one does not go with the other. The dedication of the ego to God being becomes difficult, because the ego does not accept the fact that its desires can be fulfilled by an abolition of itself. The greatest sorrow of the ego is its feeling that its existence is going to be affected by the devotions of religion. People are afraid to turn towards God because of the feeling that they will lose things of this world. Religious devotions sometimes have a subtle suspicion at their back that the gain of God may imply a loss of things in this world. Now here, we are in a difficult situation. Nobody wishes to have a loss of anything that is worthwhile. And who can say that the world does not contain worthwhile things? The world is grandiose. And it contains riches which can entertain anyone in this world indefinitely and infinitely. The individual soul which recognizes the values of the grandeur of the world feels that the absorption of itself into the being of God would be not merely a loss of things, but the loss of its own self. But it is foolish in imagining this manner, because in the gaining of God, it is not losing all things, but gaining all things. The things of the world are reflections of reality. They are not originals. And God is the original of all things. The trees that you see, the mountains that you see, the sun and the moon and the stars and yourself and myself, all are reflections. And therefore, one shadow is running after another shadow, as it were. There is no reality here in this world. The originals are in a superior realm. And highest original of all things that are reflected here in the form of perceptions and experiences is God the Absolute. So it would be stupid on the part of anyone to imagine that to move towards God would be to lose things in this world. You are losing only stupidities, shadows, unrealities, reflections, imaginations, and chimeras. But the mind is not tutored and educated properly in this manner. So it is clinging to phantoms in spite of instructions repeatedly given to it by masters, sages, and scriptures. So we have to instruct ourselves adequately into the great truth that the movement of our soul to God is the only duty of ours in this world. We have no other duty here. All our duties, family duties, national duties, public duties, and private duties are summed up in the all-consuming duty of the movement of the soul to God. But the mind will not accept it again. And to make it accept and to make it understand is to educate it in the proper manner. The Bhagavad Gita is a great instruction, a great education provided to the soul in the matter of enlivening and illuminating it in the direction of what is truly good for it. Mamupetya punarjanma dukkhalayam shashvatam napunanti mahatmanah. Great souls, blessed ones, who have realized the truths of life, will resort wholeheartedly to this fulfillment and performance of the great duty of all duties, the love of God, devotion to the Ishvara, and a continuous practice of meditation, whereby the whole of us is consecrated as a sacrament at the altar of God. This world is full of sorrow, dukkhalayam. Everyone knows what this world is made of. Whatever we touch becomes pitch and coal. We are frustrated at every step. We are defeated in our endeavors to grab the satisfactions of this world. All the fruits of life which we put into our mouth appear to turn into dust and ashes, which we realize only too late in our lives. In the hot-blooded youth and the energy of jubilant enthusiasm, when we are young in age, we do not realize what is going to be our fate when we are old. All our desires become emaciated. The things of the world look insipid and tasteless. All that we ran after looks ugly and meaningless. When life wanes like the evening flower, its beauty goes in a minute. Therefore, we are admonished again, this is a world of sorrow, dukkhalaya, and it is impermanent. It is not a permanent existence. To this sorrow-ridden world you will not return, having attained God by this practice of the unitedness of your entire spirit with the Supreme Being of God. Hari Om Tat Sat.